All right, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241.
Doesn't sound right.
It's on. Bio 241. Bio 241. Bio 241. Bio. Can you hear me? Doesn't sound like it's on. But it must be on,
sort of. I'm getting feedback.
All right, Bio 241. It's December 7th. And this is the last lecture. And let's see, where are we? We're going to finish up urinary system, and then maybe I'll draw some reproductive system physiology on the board for you. So you don't have any slides to print out, PowerPoint slides. And you do have two quizzes on the reproductive system. One, and they're both due on the 15th. That's the day after the final. So one quiz is on the male reproductive system, and the other quiz is going to be on the female reproductive system. So I want to go over that just a little bit to help you answer some of those questions. All right, so what else do we have besides today? We have the final on December 14th, okay, which is a Monday, which, as a matter of fact, it's a week from today. Oh, I'm sorry, that is a Tuesday. Thank you. Tuesday. So that is a week from today. I had that right. All right, so what's going to be covered on that test? It's going to be, okay, so the last test went to 13, so it's going to be 14, cardiovascular system, respiratory physiology, 16, and renal physiology, 17. So that's all I'm going to have on the final. Yeah, I'll be happy to repeat that. So there's three chapters. Looks like there's three chapters on the final, which is cardiovascular physiology. That is 1-3, chapter 1-3. Oh, no. Forget that. Cardiovascular physiology is chapter 14, 1-4. All right, chapter 14. Then respiratory physiology, 16. That's 1-6. And then renal physiology, which is chapter 17, 1-7, right? So that's what's on there. No figures from digestive system or diversification system. But you should review those figures in Blackboard because it will probably help you take the quizzes in Blackboard. Here's a sign-in sheet, your last sign-in sheet. And also, you do not have a lecture on Thursday. What was that? Somebody was commenting about what? The feedback? The who? Oh, that's right. We are sad about that. But anyway, if you're sad, I just wish you happy Festivus anyway. Okay, that will brighten your spirits, I'm sure. Okay, yeah. So it starts at 10:30, I believe. 10:30 to 12:30. You have a full 2 hours to do that on the 14th. That's when your final is, but it's just a standard test. But it might have more than 100 questions, okay? It's going to be about 100, somewhere in there. So it's just a regular kind of test. So always pay attention to exactly how many questions there are. Yeah, another question.
Same Scantron?
Yeah, same Scantron. The usual, what is that, an
8-8?
It's green. Yeah, it's either a 2 or a 4. I forget which one it is. 882? 882ES is a good one. Don't get them with the bubbles filled in with the green marker. Those don't work as well. There was another question someplace. Is there another question someplace? No? You're good? All right. Yeah. Yeah, reproductive system. Well, you might have to see me. You might have to see me because I don't... Okay, I don't know which one. So I don't want to take time away from lecture to look at that right now because it would take 10 or 15 minutes maybe to figure out what question it is unless you know which one it is. Okay, so I'll be happy to look at that. So the last quiz will be activated late tonight or maybe in the morning. Okay, yeah. Yeah, I think the last four quizzes are due on the 15th. Last four. Of December, which is the day after the final. So I won't compute your final grades until that day. So it won't be until the 16th that I get your final grades in there. Oh, yeah, there is a question in the back. Okay, you guys hold on, because I can't hear the question way in the back. Yeah.
There's,
yeah. Yeah, I think there was a quiz before that too, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. Yeah, there's another one being activated tonight, which is on the female reproductive system.
Okay.
It's not open yet. Okay. So usually it opens when on Tuesday around midnight-ish kind of thing like that. Okay. All right. So if I got time, I'll talk about the I'll talk about reproductive system on the board a little bit. Yeah. Oh yeah, they were in the study guide. Yeah, they're in the study guide. So they're not in your. Let me show you. We talked about this one. You see it on the screen? Right here? All right, let me work the lights just a little bit. It's weird. The lights are weird. They're going to hopefully work on this over a break. So here is one of the figures that are not in your book. It is an exam figure. All right, you guys, come to order. Because I don't want to turn the microphone up because it might feedback and blow everybody's eardrums out. So, okay, pay attention. Because you're going to want to know this for the test. That's a key word, right? Key phrase. All right, so this figure is not in your textbook. And you do have to know how to label it. So I erased a bunch of the things that you have to know and put that in your study guide. But also in the study guide is this figure that is labeled. So the key is there, right? Even though the key is not in your textbook, you do have the key. So there are two figures, the ADH figure mechanism and the aldosterone mechanism figure. So you have both. You've got the one to practice and the key for the exam. Because these are important figures that just kind of recapitulate a bunch of important concepts that you learn throughout the whole class. All right, transcription, whether signaling molecules are hydrophobic or hydrophilic. All right, so you have to remember all of that stuff. All right, so I think last time we were talking about the juxtaglomerular apparatus and how it helps regulate blood pressure and tubular glomerular feedback. All right, and I think we did talk about this figure right here about potassium resorption. So remember which way resorption goes. Resorption goes from filtrate into blood. And all of the potassium is resorbed in the proximal tubule, but if your body has too much potassium, it can be secreted in the distal tubular segments, right? So, and that's going to be under the control of aldosterone. So that kind of leads us into talking about aldosterone. And we did talk about the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism, and it begins, right, at the juxtaglomerular apparatus. Now, what organ are we in? What organ are we in? Where's that juxtaglomerular apparatus at? Give me the name of the organ. Yeah, kidney. All right, so it's in the kidney, and it's a part of the nephron, and it is where the ascending loop of Henle passes right between the afferent arteriole and efferent arteriole, and hopefully you could draw this out blindfolded and label it. All right, so you should be able to think about this very easily now. So here is a special structure called the juxtaglomerular apparatus. It's composed of a number of different kinds of cells. In the tubule, we have the macula densa cells that can monitor osmolality and the flow rate through the distal tubule. And we have granular cells that help make up the afferent arteriole, and they can secrete renin, but they can also cause contraction of smooth muscle of the afferent arteriole to help regulate the amount of blood flow entering the glomerulus. Now, why is that important? Why is blood flow through the glomerulus important to control? What is, in reality, what is that really controlling?
Calcium.
the filtration rate, right? So when we get vasoconstriction, glomerular filtration decreases. When we get vasodilation of the afferent arterial, glomerular filtration increases. That's an intrinsic mechanism of the kidney. So for instance, if blood pressure increases, we're going to have increased flow through the glomerulus, increased glomerular filtration, and what the nephron can do all by itself is cause vasoconstriction, which will then bring glomerular perfusion or filtration back down to where it should be. All right, so that's an intrinsic property of the kidney. All right, these granular cells here also monitor blood pressure. So blood pressure decreases, they're going to release renin into the circulatory system. And I think that's the slide that we're at right now. All right, and renin is a compound. Who can tell me something about renin? Because you've probably studied renin already. Is it a signaling molecule, or is it a structural feature of the red blood cell, or what's it doing in the blood? We see it's coming from the granular cells, but it's what? It's something that can reduce the activation energy of a chemical reaction. What do we call that? That's an enzyme. Yeah, so it's going to catalyze a reaction, right? So renin is not a hormone. It is an enzyme. It converts angiotensinogen into angiotensin 1. And when you look at this, you should realize something about angiotensinogen, which is what? It's inactive because of the suffix right here, but it is at sufficient concentration to have the proper physiologic control in the body, right? Because it can be activated very quickly into angiotensin 1. We don't have to build angiotensin 1 or 2 de novo, which would take many hours to do that. So this process is very quick. And angiotensin 1, all right, is a signaling compound. It's not an enzyme, but it's not very active. It's converted into angiotensin 2 by some enzymes that are in both the kidneys and the lung. Primarily, we say the lung. And what the heck is the name of that enzyme that converts 1 into 2? Angiotensin converting enzyme, or ACE, right? All right, and then angiotensin 2, which is a hormone, stimulates the release of aldosterone. And where is aldosterone synthesized and released from? The adrenal cortex, right? So then aldosterone is now floating around in the blood. It is a hormone, and it is a mineralocorticoid. So is it going to affect glucose metabolism? No, that would be a glucocorticoid from the adrenal cortex, right? It's going to affect what? Sodium and potassium in particular. All right, so inadequate intake of sodium always causes decreased blood volume because we need that osmotic property of blood to help resorption of water, right? And because a lower osmolality inhibits ADH, that causes less reabsorption of water from the kidney. Low blood volume and renal blood flow both stimulate release of renin. Now, who releases renin again? What organ was that? That was the kidney. What part of the kidney? The juxtaglomerular apparatus, and then what part of the juxtaglomerular apparatus? It's the granular cells, right? Okay, so these granular cells release renin. That's going to increase blood pressure, and we're going to look and see how that happens, all right? But also, when blood pressure decreases, the baroreceptor reflex is initiated, and there are sympathetic nerves that go to the granular cells. They are innervated by the sympathetic nervous system, and that will also cause the release of renin from granular cells, increasing sympathetic tone. So what kind of things stimulate or activate your sympathetic nervous system? What kinds of things can do that? What kinds of stimuli will activate it? Well, like stress, for instance, maybe some finals coming up. Maybe you guys have a couple finals next week. I'm not too sure about that. So that is going to have a direct effect on blood pressure via the release of renin, right, from the granular cells, and we're gonna see that mechanism. So stress can increase blood pressure, right, just due to the release of renin. Okay. All right, but let's look at dietary effects first on sodium intake. So if we have low sodium intake, and is sodium an important what do we want to call it? Molecule in your body? Yeah, because it's what? It's an electrolyte, so it helps adjust what? All the electrical properties of your body. So it's important for what? Action potentials, right, in particular. All right, so when you have low sodium intake, you have low plasma sodium concentration, right? Which means you have low osmolality of the blood, and the hypothalamus has osmolar receptors that can measure the osmolality of the blood. And when it starts to decrease, it will signal the posterior pituitary. How does signals get into the posterior pituitary? Because how many pituitaries do you have? Well, you got two. You got an anterior and a posterior. How is the posterior connected up to the hypothalamus? Just very generally. Is it through a blood vessel or is it through a tract? It's a tract, right? So there are neuron cell bodies in the hypothalamus, and then the axons course through the infundibulum down into the posterior pituitary, right? So when there's an action potential reaching that axon terminus in the posterior pituitary, it will release, or some axons will release ADH. But in this particular case, right, the posterior pituitary is inhibited because of low plasma sodium concentration, so ADH decreases. Then ADH goes to the kidney, and you saw that what does ADH do in the kidney? It inserts aquaporins into the collecting duct, and since now you have decreased ADH, you don't have so many aquaporins in the collecting duct, so you get less water reabsorption from the collecting ducts, which means then urine volume increases, so you're decreasing resorption of water in the collecting duct. When you produce more urine, right, what happens to blood volume? It goes down. All right, so that's going to stimulate the baroreceptor reflex when your blood pressure decreases, so that increases sympathetic nerve activity. Blood volume is also monitored by not just baroreceptors, but also the granular cells of the juxtaglomerular apparatus. So both that increased sympathetic activity and a direct effect on the granular cells is going to cause an increased renin secretion, which does what? Converts angiotensinogen into angiotensin 1, which then the lung converts into angiotensin 2, so they're kind of skipping a step right here. Then angiotensin 2 goes to the adrenal cortex, which then releases aldosterone, right? And aldosterone then goes to the kidney, goes through the circulation to the kidney, and it causes the increase of sodium resorption in the collecting duct. So we're going to talk about the distal tubules inside the kidney, which then does what? That increases sodium concentration in the blood, and you can see that this response is opposite to what the stimulus is, so this is a nice negative feedback mechanism, right, employed using both ADH and aldosterone to maintain proper levels of sodium inside the body. All right, so this is a pretty important exam figure for you to know, including this one right here. So here is kind of the companion slide to that ADH. This figure is not in your textbook, but in the exam study guide, you have this figure plus the one that could show up on the exam with all these things whited out. So let's go over this figure. So in order to understand this figure, you got to know the anatomy. So what compartments are we looking at? Well, here is filtrate or urine that's in the distal tubule, and this could be like the distal convoluted tubule or even a collecting duct, the beginning parts of a collecting duct, and those are what? All distal tubules of the nephron. And then we have the simple cuboidal epithelium that makes up the duct right here, right? It's just a simple cuboidal epithelium. So here's the lumen. Here are the cells. And then we have an interstitial space, which kind of looks a little pinkish to me, I guess. Is that pink? No, not at all. Beige, okay, beige. And then we have the endothelium of this capillary, right? And so what's the function here? Exchange can take place. And then we have blood. So we got blood, interstitial space, the wall of the tube, and then the lumen of the tubule right here. So let's look at the interaction of all these three different spaces. Well, here we got aldosterone in the blood. That's where we left off on the previous slide, right? What's going to cause release of aldosterone? Angiotensin 2, right? That's in the blood. It's going to cause release of aldosterone from the adrenal cortex. So it's high in the blood. It can diffuse out of this capillary. Now, what kind of molecule is aldosterone? Is it a protein? Is it sugar? It's a steroid. So it's a lipid, right? It's hydrophobic. So it's probably bound to carrier proteins so that it's soluble in blood. They can dissociate. move into the interstitial space. And what about when it bumps into this cuboidal cell right here? Where is it going to go? Is it trapped outside the cell, or can it enter? It can enter because it's hydrophobic, right? It's a lipid-soluble compound, so it can diffuse across the membrane. So there are no surface receptors for aldosterone. There are cytoplasmic receptors, right? And so it binds to a cytoplasmic receptor, which then translocates into the nucleus. And a lot of hydrophobic signaling compounds activate the cell, not through second messengers, but act as what? Transcription factors. All right. And so what the heck is transcription? Who can tell me something about transcription? It's converting information in DNA into information in RNA. That's right. So that is transcription, and it's what? The first step in protein synthesis. It's the very first step. So protein synthesis requires transcription, and then what? Translation later on outside the nucleus. So this receptor, aldosterone complex, acts as a transcription factor which initiates protein synthesis and makes a bunch of messenger RNA, right? A number of different kinds of messenger RNA that leaves the nucleus, right, and acts as the basis for translation. So the cell is going to make some new proteins. It can make new channel proteins, right? It can also make other kinds of proteins that will regulate the proteins that are already active and placed inside the apical membrane right here, right? And it can also then make new ATP pumps. And what kind of pumps are we mostly interested here? Those would be the sodium-potassium pumps. Right? Okay, so aldosterone can increase new channels. It can make regulatory proteins that can open up existing channels in the apical membrane, and it can make new proteins that get inserted into the basolateral membrane right here, which are sodium-potassium pumps. All right, so when that happens, look what we have. We have low potassium in the filtrate right here. Why do we have low potassium in the filtrate? What happened to potassium? Let's go back. Let's see if I can go back without getting everybody nauseated with flipping sides too much. Look, in this proximal tubule, what happens to potassium? 100% of it gets resorbed. So what's the potassium concentration in the filtrate in this ascending limb of the loop of Henle, or the very proximal segment of this distal tubule right here? What's potassium concentration? It's basically zero, right? So there's a huge potassium concentration difference, which says what? Well, that allows diffusion to take place. All right, so just by putting this channel in, potassium leaves the cell because of a huge concentration gradient. All right, sodium is at a high concentration inside the tubule, as it always is outside the cell. And this channel opens up, and then sodium enters the cell. And over here we have in the basolateral membrane, we have the sodium potassium ATP pump, pumping potassium from the blood or interstitial space inside the cell, maintaining what, a high concentration of potassium inside the cell and a low concentration of sodium inside the cell, pump sodium out. So now we have high sodium concentration in the interstitial space, it diffuses into the blood. So the overall effect of aldosterone in the blood via this mechanism right here is to do what? Is to increase potassium. What do we call this when potassium goes from blood to filtrate? That is tubular. Tubular what? Let's review the processes in the nephron. What are the three processes? Tubular filtration, tubular resorption, and tubular secretion. What do we call this when it goes from the blood in a capillary around some kind of tube, right? So we're not talking about the glomerulus right here, but going from blood to filtrate. What is that? That's tubular secretion. Yeah, so aldosterone causes tubular secretion of potassium, okay, and sodium resorption as a result. All right, and even the slide is labeled. So here we see potassium secreted and sodium is resorbed. All right, so you got to know where in the nephron this is. So that's the distal tubules, right, and the initial parts of the collecting duct. All right, so that's always going to help you remember what aldosterone does on the kidney. It does what? Secretes potassium and resorbs sodium. So when you say secretion, that means it's lost in urine. When you say resorption, it's put back in your body. All right, and if for whatever reason when you're taking a board exam, if you can't remember this diagram right here, and you have a number of different choices, and you almost have it clear in your mind, but you don't have that perfect moment of clarity, what answer are you going to pick? Potassium and sodium do what? They go in opposite directions, right? Opposite directions, right? And maybe then that will help you figure out which way they go. You lose potassium, but you gain sodium as a result of aldosterone. Okay, so this is a particularly important diagram that you should know, because what can you tell me about the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism, which we talked about on this slide right here, right? And in other chapters, kind of finished off with the little molecular mechanisms of how it works. Why is that an important mechanism? What's it doing for us? It's the most important mechanism for what? For long-term regulation of blood pressure. All right. What's the most important mechanism for short-term regulation of blood pressure? That you should have on the tip of your tongue, too. That's the baroreceptor reflex. That's right. So baroreceptor for short-term regulation, the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism for long-term regulation. And remember a couple chapters ago, we also talked about a number of important pharmaceutical agents that can help regulate that renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism, for instance, if somebody does have hypertension. All right, so that works through that same mechanism. All right, so the macula densa, which is right here in the tubule, they are in contact with the granular cells, and the macula densa cells act as a sensor for tubuloglomerular feedback, which is needed for what? Intrinsic control of glomerular filtration rate within the kidney. And so it signals the afferent arteriole to constrict, which is going to decrease glomerular filtration. Right, so, and it can signal the granular cells to decrease secretion of renin when blood sodium is high. Right, so remember, when blood sodium is low, aldosterone increases because it's going to cause resorption of sodium. So here's a little table that just kind of shows some effects. Some stimulus, decreased blood volume, increased blood volume. You should know which way blood pressure goes with that. Right? If there's increased potassium, increased sympathetic nerve activity. Right? Renin secretion is increased when blood volume is low. It's decreased when blood volume is high. So that translates into when blood volume is low, increased aldosterone release. When blood volume is high, it's decreased. And then that's going to help regulate blood pressure. Right? So when blood volume is low, increased aldosterone will bring blood pressure back up. And when blood volume is high, decreasing aldosterone, right, is going to bring blood pressure back down. And you're going to lose sodium as a result of that. Increased sympathetic nerve activity can stimulate the granular cells directly, releasing renin. Right? That's going to increase angiotensin II. That's going to increase aldosterone. And that's going to have alpha adrenergic effects, constricting the afferent arterioles. Beta adrenergic effects stimulates renin secretion directly from the granular cells. All right, so the kidney is very important for controlling blood pressure. The last hormone, all right, we looked at three hormones for controlling blood volume. That was ADH, aldosterone, and then atrial natriuretic peptide, or hormone. I call it hormone. So tell me something about this atrial natriuretic hormone. Yeah, great concept. It's antagonistic to both aldosterone and ADH, right? So, where does it come from?
The heart.
The heart, the atria. And what is it going to work on? What does this term right here, natriuretic, mean? What does natri mean? What is that referring to? Sodium, right? Natrium, and uretic means that it's going to promote the excretion of sodium via the urine. All right, so it's produced by the atria due to overstretching of the atria, like when you have excessive venous return because you have a large blood volume. It's antagonistic to aldosterone, stimulates salt and water excretion in the kidney, right? So it acts as an endogenous diuretic. So what does that do to venous return when the atria secretes atrial natriuretic hormone? That produces a diuresis, that produces a lot of urine, that decreases blood volume. So you have less volume of blood going back to the atria, so you don't have quite so much filling of the atria during diastole, and so the stretch of the atria then is relieved as a result of that. So it's a nice negative feedback mechanism. All right, so that's it for the urinary system, right? But I don't have a mechanistic diagram that shows you how atrial natriuretic hormone really works like we did for ADH and aldosterone. So that's it for urinary system. Okay, so let's talk about reproductive system a little bit. I might have to turn the microphone off because I'm going to be up here close to the blackboard. Okay, so who knows what the reproductive system is all about? How much time we got? Oh, we got a couple minutes. Good, we got a couple minutes. Yeah. Yeah, ADH and aldosterone. Yeah, ADH and aldosterone, they're in the study guide for that chapter. Okay, so they're in there. All right, yeah, I don't know about that microphone. All right, so what's the function of that reproductive system?
Reproduction.
You're going to say, reproduction.
Yes.
But, yeah, but I wouldn't be asking that question if it was so obvious. Okay, but it really is obvious. But I need to change your impression just a little bit. Okay, you think reproduction. There are a lot of organisms that reproduce in a different way, right? Now, I'm sure you're all aware that reproductive system in humans is very complicated. There's a bunch of us that have a penis and a prostate gland. There's others of us that have a uterus and ovaries and fallopian tubes, different hormones. It's very complicated. Why is it so complicated? There's got to be a good reason for it, okay? There are a lot of organisms that reproduce, for instance, like a hydra, which is an animal that lives in water. It's a polyp, has a bunch of tentacles on it, and it's got a body tube, right? And it grabs little crustaceans in the water, and it feeds itself via the tentacles because there's little stinging cells on it. And when it wants to reproduce, it just starts to grow a little hydra from the side, right, with little tentacles on it. And then when that little hydra is big enough, it breaks off from the parent plant, and then there's like another hydra there on the ground, growing, feeding itself. And that doesn't happen to us, right? I mean, you never grow like little babies out of your side, right, and drop off. Now, what's the difference between that parent hydra and the one that broke away from the parent plant? They're exactly the same. They're like clones of each other, okay? Now, when we reproduce, all right, what's the offspring like? Is it a clone of the parent? Absolutely not. And as a matter of fact, so the reason for the reproductive system, in my way of thinking, is really as plain as the nose on our faces, which is what, if you look around the room? Every nose is different. Every person is different. So the bottom line is exactly right. It produces diversity in the population. So really the function of our reproductive system is not just to reproduce the same human over and over and over again, but to produce something new and unique. That's what's really important, okay? And that's important because what happens if there's a cold going around or a flu going around right now? Is everybody going to get sick with that flu? No. And what's the reason why? Because we're a diverse population, but what does that really mean? It means that because we reproduce sexually. We all don't come down with the same disease processes because we reproduce sexually. That's the important thing. So every person is new and unique. So a good question I could ask you is, if you look around the room right now, of course, you're not going to see another you. But say you go to a place like the Coliseum where they're going to hold a football game and there's 100,000 people there, right? Are you going to find another you there? No. If you now look over the whole world, are you going to find another you anywhere? Huh? Oh, you got some questions on that? Okay. There's never going to be another you. Okay? You're really unique. Now, what about your parents? All right, since they produced you at one point in time, and let's just say 20 years later they produced some other offspring, could they produce another you?
No.
Why, you're so sure about that? Okay. Well, you know what? If they produced you, they could produce another you. Why not? I don't see why not. But the odds of that happening are just so astronomical, it really has never happened, and it will probably never, ever happen. All right? Because the biology involved introduces so much variability that it just probably won't ever happen. And even if there are people on other planets and other galaxies, it's so astronomically high, it probably would never, ever happen, though it is possible. Okay. So we can't get into the genetics of this very much, but I want to describe some of the hormonal control of the reproductive system, which kind of ensures why we're all so different from each other. It produces diversity, right? So the function of the reproductive system is basically to produce diversity, and it's one of my favorite ironies in life. Does anybody know what irony is? It's kind of like a paradoxical. You do one thing and the opposite result happens. Like, for instance, everybody was very interested in computers because we wanted to get away from paperwork. Okay, but what have computers done? They've even made more paperwork for us. Okay, so that, to me, that's irony. Okay, so one of my favorite ironies with the reproductive system is that, what's the function of the reproductive system again? Produce diversity, right? Well, what I find very ironic is that people love sex, but hardly anybody loves diversity. But what's the purpose of sex? Diversity. So you need to change your opinion on that just a little bit. So how is this controlled? What kind of hormones are involved with this? Huh? Gonads. Yeah, we're going to get to the gonads in just a little bit. Okay. Well, where does this all start off? You're familiar with this, so this is just kind of a review. So what do we got right here? That kind of looks like a brain to me. All right, so we're going to start with the brain, like temporal lobe, right frontal. And if we do a nice sagittal section, right in about this part of the brain, maybe about this part of the brain right here, there's something called the hypothalamus, right? And the hypothalamus is connected to a little gland right here, which is the, you're reading my mind, I'm sure, this is the pituitary gland, right? That's the pituitary. And it's a little infundibulum that connects to the hypothalamus. So the hypothalamus controls the pituitary. How does it do that? Remember from endocrinology, releasing factors or releasing hormones? And in particular, since we're talking about the reproductive system, we're going to talk about gonadotropin-releasing hormone, right? So the hypothalamus releases GnRH, which goes to the anterior pituitary via that portal vein, GnRH. And then the anterior pituitary in particular, right, because the posterior, what does a posterior release? We just got done talking about it. ADH, ADH and oxytocin, which I don't know if we can get to talking about today or not. GnRH is going to cause the release of gonadotropins. All right, and there are two gonadotropins. What are they? Can you recall from the exam? It was a good exam figure. Most everybody got it right, so I know you know somewhere in there. It is what? FSH and LH. Okay. All right, and since it says in the name right here, what's the target tissue for gonadotropins? They are the gonads. That's right. And those are the primary reproductive structures. So in the male, they're testes, and in the female, they are ovaries, right? So we're going to consider both of those cases, males and females, all right? So how does FSH and LH from the anterior pituitary, let me put an A right here, anterior pituitary get to the gonads? Just through the circulatory system, right? Because they're hormones, right? So it travels through the circulatory system, all right? And so for the male right here, and let me see, let me put female over here. Both males and females release FSH and LH. Action is a little bit different because, what, our gonads are a little bit different. All right, so FSH in the male FSH causes spermatogenesis. Uh-oh, I'm going to run out of board. All right, spermatogenesis. All right, so there are germ cells that can be converted into sperm cells. That's spermatogenesis. Germ to sperm. Germ to sperm. That's spermatogenesis. All right, but that's dependent on another hormone, namely testosterone. And so LH goes to interstitial cells, or cells of Leydig. And it causes these cells to release testosterone. And testosterone supports spermatogenesis as well as secondary sex characteristics. Like, what are some secondary sex characteristics? Okay, for instance, like the lack of breasts in males. Characteristics. All right, well, but what are some other secondary sex characteristics of the male? Voice, for instance. Men's larynxes are bigger, right, and thicker, and so vocal cords vibrate at a lower frequency. So voice, for instance. Hair is important, right? So distribution and the texture. Texture is coarser, more, there's a bigger distribution of hair all over the body. Okay, muscles typically are bigger and stronger. Bones typically are bigger and stronger as a result of testosterone. That's why osteoporosis is not such an important clinical problem in males compared to females, because males can afford to lose more bone before they get brittle, right, with age. All right, so that's what I want you to know for male. FSH causes spermatogenesis. LH causes release of testosterone. That's pretty simple for the male. And this process of spermatogenesis takes place the whole life cycle of the male, decreases a little bit with age, but not too much. Okay, so what is the process right here that takes a germ cell and makes a sperm cell out of it? I want to talk about the human life cycle just a little bit. Human life cycle. So here we have a typical cell that you have in your body, and I think I drew this on the board for you once before. Most cells in your body have how many chromosomes in them? We didn't study this necessarily, but there's 46. But there's a special arrangement of 46 because they didn't come all from the same person. You got half from somebody and half from the other somebody in your life, right? So you got two sets. So there's a 1, 2, all the way down to number 23 here. And a 1, 2, all the way down to number 23 over here. You add those up, that's 46. So you got half of your chromosomes from your mom, right? And then the other half of your chromosomes from your dad, which we call what? Maternal versus paternal chromosomes, and that is 46. And since you have two copies of every chromosome, we call this a diploid condition. So the ploidy of most cells in your body are diploid. You have two copies. Okay. But there is a certain process then that reduces 46 chromosomes down to 23. And in the male, that's going to be called an egg cell. And if it's a male, all right, two different people, individuals, you're going to call that a sperm. All right, and there's 23 chromosomes in there. All right, so we're talking about taking a germ cell, which is this, that has 46 chromosomes, making a sperm out of it. What's the name of that process? And I'm not going to ask you to understand the intricacies of the process, but you should at least know the name. Okay? So it's reproducing cells, right? But it's a nuclear reduction, so it's not mitosis. It's what we call meiosis, right? So M-E-I-O-S-I-S. So meiosis is a process that produces these sex cells, but the proper name for a sex cell is a gamete. Okay, so where do gametes get produced? In what? Gonads. in the gonads, right? Which is either a testes or an ovary. So one of the functions of a gonad is what? Produce gametes via process of meiosis. All right, now under the proper circumstances, these two can get together, right? And where do these things usually get together? Fallopian tube, okay? Inside the fallopian tube is usually where this process happens, and it produces what? Another cell. These chromosomes are added together, so you're back at how many? 46. All right, this cell right here is what we call a zygote. This, the way that we talk about this chromosome number is the same as this germ cell right here. This is a diploid cell. But these gametes right here only have half the number, so we call these haploids. All right, so what is the name of this process where we take two haploid cells and make a diploid cell out of it in a fallopian tube? What's that called? Somebody said it up there. Yeah. That's fertilization, right? So this is fertilization right here. That's fertilization. And what can you tell me about this cell? It's new and unique in terms of its chromosomes, the arrangements and kinds of chromosomes that it's had. All right, and then what do we got? We got this zygote, and it's going to do what? How do you get from a zygote to this condition right here? What do we call that process? And I think you had to know this. It was one of the important reasons why this happens. This is what we call what? Growth. But what's the real term that I'm looking for here? It's not meiosis. Yeah, gestation happens in here. Okay, mitosis. So you start with a single cell. But you don't live your whole life as a single cell because it wouldn't be very interesting, right? You couldn't come and take a physiology final or anything like that, or take notes, right? So when you go from a single cell to trillions of cells over here, this is what? Mitosis. That's what I'm after. All right, and then this individual has gonads with germ cells, and this process can repeat itself. So that's the human life cycle. Okay, so we're done here with male. Let's go over to female. Right here. Gonadotropins, FSH and LH, go from the anterior pituitary to ovary. And there are primary oocytes in an ovary that are in the process of meiosis. And during gestation, all right, that process will produce about 2 million potential gametes. All right, and when a person is born, when a female is born, they're born with all the possible gametes that they can ever produce in their lifetime. So that's unlike the male, which does what? Produce gametes over and over and over again. But by the time a person is born, there's only about 100,000 gametes left in an ovary. So about half have died and regressed. And then by the time a female reaches puberty, about 75,000 of those potential gametes actually die and regress as well. So you're born with maybe 25,000 to 50,000 gametes that can actually become fertilized, which is what? More than enough children that you would ever really want to have in your lifetime, right? So that's not such a big deal. Female doesn't have to produce new gametes throughout their whole life cycle. Okay, but all of those gametes inside the ovary are immature, right? They're kind of waiting to be activated. So at the onset of puberty, FSH in the female, FSH in female causes egg maturation, egg or follicle maturation. So during the monthly cycle, maybe about 3 or 4 or 5 immature eggs are going to start to mature into a mature follicle, so a handful of them. In that process, almost all of them regress and then become resorbed, but one reaches maturity. And right at mid-cycle, LH then causes ovulation. Okay, so FSH causes follicle maturation. And when a follicle is mature, LH will cause ovulation of that egg from a follicle. So you can kind of see that this is sort of similar, because what is FSH in the male? It causes spermatogenesis. FSH in the female causes a mature follicle to develop. So it's kind of an analogous procedure. Okay, so that happens in the ovary. So what's the function of this ovary right here? Is to produce, what is this? What is going to be ovulated right here? An egg. What is an egg? Egg is really what? A gamete. Produces gametes. Okay. Let's go back to the testes. What's the function of the testes over here? To produce gametes as well as to produce testosterone. So two functions. For any kind of gonad, where do I have gonads? On the board, right over here. Two functions for gonads. It produces gametes, and number two, sex steroids. And in the male, there's only one, testosterone. But in the female, there are actually two. Right, there's the analog to testosterone, which is estrogen. All right, and then there's another one called progesterone. Hold on. Oh, I just left an N off. Estrogen. Okay. So, let me tell you where estrogen comes from. Estrogen comes from a follicle. All right, so I want to put an arrow right here. And during the cycle, as FSH levels increase, the number of follicles that are maturing increase, but the size of a follicle that is growing gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Right? It proliferates, and you have many more cells, and then all of the estrogen that those cells are producing adds up. So during the monthly cycle, estrogen increases as a follicle is maturing. Right? And when follicles are growing, they don't produce any progesterone. Right at mid-cycle, when there's this LH surge that causes ovulation, an egg is expelled from a follicle. So one cell gets released from a follicle. You're still left with thousands of cells that are endocrine cells that have been secreting estrogen. All right, so then what happens at ovulation, that follicle becomes something we call the corpus luteum. All right, so the egg is now ovulated from the ovary someplace in the pelvic cavity, or maybe found its way into a fallopian tube, hopefully. Okay, and the rest of the cells of that follicle don't degenerate and become resorbed. They get converted into something we call the corpus luteum, which then secretes progesterone. So now we got to talk about what the effects of estrogen and progesterone are. So think of the uterus, and how many different layers does the uterus have? I think you learned three. The perimetrium, the myometrium, and the endometrium being the deepest layer. Okay? And the endometrium is a tissue that proliferates, so it undergoes mitosis, right? It undergoes mitosis every month. And then at the end of the cycle, if implantation, pregnancy and implantation doesn't take place, then those cells are lost with a little bit of hemorrhage from the uterus, and those endometrial cells are lost. All right, and then the cycle repeats itself. So estrogen, during this first part of the cycle, produces proliferation of the endometrium. So where is estrogen produced by again? Ovary. So there's the hormones that go from the ovary to the endometrium. That's the uterus. And it causes proliferation. What does that mean? What does proliferation mean? It's growth. It's growth of the endometrium. So instead of having 10 cells there, now you've got tens of thousands of cells. They're undergoing mitosis. The endometrium is growing. Okay? But these cells, the endometrium is not ready for implantation at this point in time. After ovulation, the follicle becomes the corpus luteum, releases progesterone. Progesterone then goes to the uterus, and it causes more proliferation. Right? But also maturation of the endometrium. Right? And by maturation, I mean that it increases the blood supply or vascularity. Vascularity of the endometrium. Okay, and glands. There are glands in the endometrium that secrete a substance, and I'm not sure people really understand what kind of substance it is, but it aids in implantation of a fertilized egg. So that's the job of progesterone. It puts the final touches on the endometrium, okay, for implantation. All right, so males don't have progesterone, right, because males don't have any kind of endometrium, right? There's no tissue in a male for implantation to take place. All right, if implantation does not take place, all right, after about 10 days, right, after 10 days with no implantation, the CL, which is corpus luteum, degenerates. And when the corpus luteum degenerates, progesterone levels decrease. And when progesterone what was the effect of progesterone? It was stimulating the endometrium. All right, so when progesterone goes away, what happens to the endometrium? It regresses. The cells die, right, and then they're lost from the uterus. All right, so no implantation. But what happens if there is implantation? What happens to this corpus luteum? Okay, let's draw this up over here. If implantation takes place, all right, then there is something that's forming. All right, some viable placental tissue. So the embryo can implant into the endometrium. Some parts of the endometrium and the embryo join together to form a placenta. That's sort of an interesting organ because it's actually made out of two different individuals. The viable placenta, right, secretes a hormone called human chorionic gonadotropin. All right, what's a gonadotropin? It's something that promotes the growth of a gonad, which is, in this case, an ovary. All right, so human chorionic gonadotropin goes to the ovary, and what is it going to find inside the ovary? Follicles or a corpus luteum? Corpus luteum, because this is after ovulation. Human chorionic gonadotropin, all right, goes to the corpus luteum, and it says, do not regress, but keep secreting progesterone. All right, so it's going to cause increase in progesterone. And where does progesterone go to? The uterus, to maintain the endometrium, to get it stronger. All right, and that means that the placenta is going to grow, which means what? It's going to secrete more human chorionic gonadotropin, which goes to the corpus luteum, which is going to secrete more progesterone, which is going to keep the endometrium nice and healthy for implantation. Right, when the placenta gets big enough, it can do the job of the corpus luteum. So when the placenta gets big enough, it stops secreting human chorionic gonadotropin. All right, but secretes enough progesterone by itself to maintain the uterus. So the corpus luteum will eventually regress. So that's kind of it in a nutshell. So for males, right, and females are gonadotropins, FSH and LH, being released from the anterior pituitary as a result of GnRH from the hypothalamus. In the male, FSH causes spermatogenesis, LH causes testosterone synthesis and release. In the female, FSH causes a follicle to mature. LH causes ovulation of that follicle right at mid-cycle. And these follicles, when they're developing, release estrogen that causes the development of the endometrium. Right at ovulation, the follicle is no longer there, but it becomes the corpus luteum, which secretes progesterone, which affects the endometrium again so that implantation can take place by increasing blood vessels in the endometrium and the secretion from glands in the endometrium. If implantation takes place, the corpus luteum does not regress because the placenta releases human chorionic gonadotropin, which is always written a little H, a capital C, a capital G, and this is what a pregnancy test determines. Human chorionic gonadotropin. And that level should be increasing all the time because the placenta is getting bigger. Now, every once in a while, okay, unfortunately, HCG might start to decrease. All right, what's happening there when HCG decreases? And this is kind of an important point because that means what's happening to the placenta is dying. Okay, so that means the pregnancy is terminating. Okay, it's ending. And under what circumstances can that happen? For instance, if there is an ectopic pregnancy. Okay, so if there is a pregnancy in a fallopian tube or in the mesentery someplace, remember an egg cell has no cellular structures for motility like a sperm, right? So if that egg can't get into the fallopian tube or if the fallopian tube is blocked, those sperm can still get into the pelvic cavity and abdominal cavity. They can swim around all over the place. Fertilization can take place. Implantation takes place at a site other than the uterus, and that puts that female at high risk, actually at certain risk of acute hemorrhage, and probably you could bleed out in just a number of minutes, right? So if somebody's concerned about ectopic pregnancies, it's actually followed very easily just by monitoring, what, human chorionic gonadotropin almost on a daily basis, and it should always be increasing. Should never level off or decrease. And if that happens, right, then you got to find that site for of that ectopic pregnancy, and it has to be removed. Otherwise, somebody could actually die very quickly and suddenly of that hemorrhage when that developing fetus gets too big and rips away from the blood supply in the mesentery or fallopian tube. Because the fallopian tube doesn't have that middle layer that the uterus has, which is what? The myometrium, right? And that myometrium is strong enough to maintain pregnancy throughout the whole term. And that's the only other effect that progesterone has. Right? During gestation, progesterone maintains the endometrium, but it also does something to the myometrium. Progesterone during gestation goes to myometrium. All right, sorry about writing sideways right here. It makes the myometrium nice and quiet and strong. Because during gestation, you don't want to have an irritable uterus that is contracting and relaxing. What is a spasm and then relaxation? A spasm and relaxation of a uterus, what is that? That's parturition, right? So during gestation, you want the uterus to be strong and partially contracted, but not irritable and contracting, and that's what progesterone does. It keeps the myometrium nice and strong, but quiet. All right, so the real name for progesterone is really progestational hormone, right? So that's the hormone that is at a high level when the body kind of thinks that, what, gestation is taking place. All right, so it maintains the endometrium and keeps the myometrium quiet. When it starts to decrease, that's when the uterus gets irritable, right, and the endometrium is lost. All right, so that's kind of it in a nutshell. That could help you answer some questions for the quiz on the female reproductive system.